Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome, everyone. This is an event that we are so looking forward to sharing with you tonight. Our editorial director, Tom Donadio, are thrilled to welcome you to our end-of-year reviewer event, where 8 Book Reporter reviewers are joining us to share 3 of their favorite books that were published for the first time in 2023. Reviewers hail from all over the country, and it's one of the things that we love about our website. We're not just both coasts, we're across the country. So we want to do something tonight as well. We want you to be dropping into the chat where you're from, city and state. We like to see how many states we have covered, and also what your favorite book was that was published in 2023. And we're going to give you guys just one option. So if you could just drop down below what you are most looking for, what your favorite book was and where you're from. So for tonight's event, please note we're not going to be doing a Q&A. And we're going to ask that our reviewers be very brisk in their commentary. So these are not going to be as in-depth as the reviews that you would see on the site, the reviews we know you love, but we're going to make sure you get a taste of what these books are and why they found them to be so exciting. We're going to start with Nora Peel. And Nora's husband and I share an almost birthday together, and she is going to be zipping off soon to be making his birthday dinner. So we're letting her be first again, like we did last year. Nora has worked for 10 years at the Boston Book Festival, overseeing their day-to-day operations, and most recently was the director for literary programs at the Bay Area Book Festival. She is currently the executive director at Litquake, San Francisco's literary festival. She's a former children's bookseller and has worked in the publishing industry for both university and trade publishers. So welcome, Nora. What are you going to share with us?
Thanks, Carol. So I have 3 books that I tried to sort of impose a theme onto, at least a little bit. It's just maybe a stretch, but the theme of all 3 of my recommendations is books that you should give a chance, even if you're not sure if they're for you. So the first one of those is The Guest Lecture by Martin Riker. Now, before I read this book, I had certainly never read a novel where one of the supporting characters is a long dead economist. And probably you haven't either, but that is the case in this novel. The narrator, Anna, is a present day economist and an economic historian. And the sort of setup for the novel is that she's suffering from a bout of insomnia the night before she's due to give a guest lecture at a university on an essay by John Maynard Keynes. So to make matters worse, she's not at her home. She is stuck in this tiny hotel room with her husband and her young child who have accompanied her on this business trip. So she's trapped in this room with them and with her own thoughts. She's also worried that she took her husband's advice and wants to deliver this lecture extemporaneously. So now she's feeling very unprepared. So she decides to use this ancient rhetorical method called loci, kind of similar to what I've heard as a memory palace, where you assign different portions of your speech to different rooms in a building. And then you mentally walk your way through those rooms to remember those portions of your speech. So she finds her mind wandering through rooms in her house to which she's assigned different portions of her speech. And as she does so, she engages in imaginary arguments with John Maynard Keynes himself. And she is starting to question the optimistic premise of his 1930 essay, Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, given that although she and her family are relatively privileged for sure, they certainly are not experiencing the kind of rosy economic future that he envisioned in that article. So her stream of consciousness voice is actually really funny, despite its sort of like high intellectual flavor. And although readers will learn a surprising amount about economic theory, they'll also feel like they're getting a real window into this woman's complicated inner life. The author, Martin Riker, is also a publisher. He's the co-founder of a small feminist publisher, Dorothy, a publishing project. And many of the books that they publish are also have to do with the intellectual lives of women. And so it's interesting to think of this novel as sort of participating in that as well. My second selection is another novel called A Day's Work by Chris Batchelder and Jennifer Habel. I was definitely a little apprehensive going into this one too. I wasn't sure this novel was for me, given that it is very, very concerned with Herman Melville's Moby Dick, which is a novel that I've never read and that I had no particular desire to. This is a collaboratively written novel, as I mentioned. It's by a husband and wife duo. Chris Batchelder is a novelist and his wife, Jennifer Habel, is primarily a poet. But they've collaborated on this novel that has an unnamed female protagonist, narrator, who's becoming increasingly fixated on the life and work of Herman Melville. Now, this is a quarantine novel. So not only was it written during the early days of COVID, but it's also set during that period as well. So in between the narrator's considerations of Melville and his sort of social and creative circle, we also see glimpses of the narrator's home life with her child doing Zoom school in the next room and lots of questions and uncertainties that sort of defined all of our lives back in those early months of 2020. It's also similar to The Guest Lecture in the ways in which those domestic and intellectual concerns kind of layer on top of one another and create these interesting parallels. As I mentioned, Jennifer Habel is a poet. And so even though this is definitely a novel, it's written in these very short poem-like sections, many of which are only a line or two, which encourages slow and deliberate reading, kind of like reading poetry. It's also a novel about partnerships, both sort of on a meta level, because this is a collaborative novel, but also about different kinds of personal and romantic and creative partnerships, some of which are mutually very productive and others that might be damaging or exploitative, especially to women. So if you have read Moby Dick before, you might discover a very new perspective here. And if you haven't, like me, it might inspire you to pick up that classic novel as well. And my last selection is a pretty different one. It's a memoir. It's called This Country, Searching for Home in Very Rural America by Naveed Mudavian. So this is a memoir, but it's in graphic novel form. And again, in terms of like not being sure if books are for you, I would definitely encourage readers to pick this up, even if you've never thought about reading a comic book or graphic novel before. Mudavian and his wife, Emily, decide that if they're both young people, and I think they're late 20s when the memoir starts, decide that if they want to pursue their dream of home ownership, they're going to have to leave the San Francisco Bay Area where they've been living. They're fortunate in that he's a cartoonist, she's a documentary filmmaker, so they can live pretty much anywhere. And they land in this rural area outside this tiny town in central Idaho. The population is 514. There they build a tiny house, they grow their own food, they learn about basic life skills, such as how to start a car when it's 37 degrees below zero. And they also encounter some pretty harrowing cultural differences. Naveed is the son of Iranian immigrants, and the memoir takes place right before the 2016 election and during the first couple of years of Trump's administration. So in this rural part of a very red state, the couple find plenty of folks who are very friendly and welcoming to them, but they also find some who are suspicious or hostile. So after they have a child, they have to weigh some tough decisions about whether they're going to stay where they are to raise their daughter there or if they're going to move on somewhere else. Mudavian's a New Yorker cartoonist primarily. You might recognize his style. So he's just phenomenally gifted at conveying emotions and humor with just a few very simple lines. His style is really, really clean with lots of white space on the page, but he also captures these Western vistas in his artwork and also really detailed drawings of the plant and animal life that they encounter. Like the other books that I've been talking about, this one surprised me by being funny in a lot of parts, while also offering plenty to think about in terms of various cultural divides in our country. And I think this one would also be a great selection for older teens as well as adults, especially those who are interested in thinking about immigration and related concerns. So those are my three recommendations. Thanks so much for inviting me on tonight.
Thanks for being here, Nora. We really appreciate it. Thanks for being part of our evening and happy birthday to your husband. I noticed in the chat, some people are asking about covers of the books and the list of the titles that we're talking about tonight. Anybody who was registered, I guess a couple of hours ago, that list was sent to you. So you may want to look in your email. It has pictures, the covers of all the books are in it, as well as the titles. So just keep that in mind. We didn't forget to do that. Tom, take it away.
All right, next up, we have Harvey Friedenberg. Harvey practiced intellectual property law and litigation with a large Harrisburg, Pennsylvania firm before he retired in 2017. He's been working as a freelance reviewer since 2005 and is a member of the National Book Critics Circle. He also writes for Bookpage, Shelf Awareness, and Kirkus Reviews. Harvey, it is great to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Tom. And thanks everyone for coming. It's great to see you this evening. So this year I reviewed a total of 68 books, and I've been reviewing now for about 18 years. So I have a practice every year of coming up with a dozen that are my favorites. So check back with Book Reporter sometime in the next week or so, and you'll see my full list. I've been sending them out one a day on social media as kind of a teaser. So it's a little tough to come up with three out of the total of 68 books that I reviewed. The first one is a memoir. And we were instructed if we had the books to bring along the book so we could show you the cover. So here it is, but you'll be getting this. It's a memoir entitled The Critic's Daughter by Priscilla Gilman. Priscilla's father was Richard Gilman, who was a well-known theater critic. His career started in the 60s and went into the early 2000s. He taught for about 30 years at the Yale Drama School, was very well known in that world. And Priscilla's mother is a famous literary agent whose name may be familiar to some of you, Lynn Nesbitt. Mm-hmm. She still works as literary agent into her 80s, I believe. Mm-hmm. This is the story of Richard's relationship with Lynn. Unfortunately, they divorced when Priscilla and her sister were young. That created a huge amount of tension in the relationship with the children. And what I liked about this book was that it was a very balanced portrait of her father. I read a lot of memoirs. I'm very fond of the memoir genre. And many times you'll read memoirs that seem to be a lot about score settling. This one was an attempt to really offer a balanced assessment, an intelligent, reflective assessment on the life of Richard Gilman. And it's also a beautifully written book. Priscilla herself is a literary critic. She teaches writing, she writes with a great deal of sympathy and very beautifully. So I read some really fine memoirs this year. This one rose to the top of that memoir category. My second book is a novel. And what's interesting also about these three is that they were all, I reviewed them all early in the year. Two of them I reviewed in January, February, one in April. And what happens when you're reviewing all year is that the books that you review a long time ago tend to fade in your memory. And the ones that you review most recently get elevated. But the fact that these three stayed strong in my memory really, really tells me that that these were wonderful. This book is entitled The World and All That It Holds. And I hope I'm not mispronouncing his name, Alexander Heman, who is a Bosnian Serb, I believe Serb and Ukrainian heritage, has been living in the United States since 1992. He's written both fiction and nonfiction for movie fans. He was involved in the screenwriting of one of the Matrix sequels. So he's quite a versatile writer. This novel, I think, truly deserves the title of epic. It begins in 1914 in Sarajevo, where Heman himself was born. It involves a young pharmacist by the name of Rafiar Pinto, who happens to be Jewish, who actually witnesses the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife that launches Europe into the First World War. He's drafted into service in the Austro-Hungarian army. There he meets another young Muslim soldier named Osman. They start a relationship. And the story carries Raphael and ultimately Osman and Osman's daughter over the next almost 40 years as it moves from the World War I battlefield and eventually into China. The main action of the novel ends in 1949 when the Chinese communists take over. And it's really a story, especially in a time of conflict like the one we're experiencing now in the Middle East, that gives insight into the lives of ordinary people in conflict. These are people of no real distinction, but they're caught up in these these enormous historical events. And I think Hemon does a wonderful job of putting this all in perspective. Again, a beautifully written book. That's something that I really enjoy. I don't just want a good story. I want writing that's going to carry me along. And he's a wonderful writer. Any I've read one of his other books, a nonfiction work, and anything that he writes, I certainly would want to read. And the final one of my three books is a book called American Ramble, which I know I have recommended more times than any book I've read this year to people, particularly people who like nonfiction. The author is Neil King Jr. Mr. King is a former Wall Street Journal reporter and editor, has covered stories all over the world. And American Ramble is a story of a walk that he took from his home on Capitol Hill in Washington to New York City in late March of 2021. It's about 330 miles. What appealed to me when I requested this book was that some of this walk took him very close to where I live in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He got within about 25 miles of Harrisburg, went through York, Pennsylvania, but he cut across several northeastern states in a very leisurely manner, starting out really only with an end destination in mind each day. But along the way, he really made some wonderful discoveries about history. He crossed the Delaware where Washington did. He visited the city of York, Pennsylvania, and learned a great deal about the history of the Black community there. He visited a garbage dump in New Jersey, which was kind of a remarkable story. And it's all done in a relaxed but a knowledgeable style. He did a great deal of research and preparation for this trip. And so it was a mixture of planning and serendipity. And what I really like about it, and I'm just going to read a couple of sentences at the end of the book, is that he didn't set out trying to come up with any grand theme about what America is today or where our country is heading. But in these simple daily meetings that he had with people he met along the way, he was able to glean something that for our country in a time that I think is a difficult one and where people are looking for hope, I think this book can really provide some of it. So the paragraph that I think sums this up best, he says, "I found a buoyancy and curiosity and zest among the bulk of the people I met, but thousands more shot past me on the roads and highways that I know nothing about. I am reluctant to extrapolate from my particulars to argue that we are a happy or troubled land, though I suspect we are both in unequal measure." And again, a beautifully written book, very timely. And if you live in this part of the country in the Northeast, I think it'll help you see our part of the world with new eyes. So those are my three books. I'm really appreciative for the opportunity to share them with you all. And I look forward to hearing from the other reviewers. Thanks very much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Harvey. Those are great selections. And I remember that you reviewed The Critic's Daughter for us. I remember how much you loved it. And I remember thinking at the time, it's probably going to be on his best of list at the end of the year. And sure enough, it was. Thank you so much, Harvey. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Harvey. Our next guest is Rebecca Monroe, who is a project editor at WW Norton & Company. Prior to joining Norton, she was editorial manager of Kids Reads and Teen Reads, part of the Book Report Network, sister sites to bookreporter.com. Rebecca, it's so great to see you again. She's now living up in New Hampshire. We don't run across you across the desk or even across town anymore like we used to. So no. We're looking forward to seeing what you have to share with us tonight.
Well, it's so nice to see you both. It's really exciting to be back with you guys. I am starting off with Looking for Jane by Heather Marshall. This book published, I believe, last January, so I'm a little fuzzy on the names, but I'll get there. It begins with a woman named Angela, who is a queer woman looking to adopt with her partner. So birth and parenting and motherhood are heavily on her brain. She works at an antique store, and she finds in an old bureau a letter from a woman to her daughter, confessing that though she tried her best to be the best mother she could, she had hid a terrible secret her daughter's whole life, which was that she was adopted from a home for unwed mothers. If you know any history of these places, they are historically not good. And this woman, Angela, feels it's her obligation to get this letter to the daughter because it obviously never reached her and she deserves to know the truth. The novel then bounces back to the daughter, Nancy, who at 20 years old has just discovered a terrible secret, and you can probably guess what it is. When she herself becomes unexpectedly pregnant, she is very conscious of the choices and the obligations and the barriers. And when she is looking into her options, she discovers that there is a network of underground doctors, nurses, secretaries, and just regular women helpers known as the Jane Collective. These women help other women seek safe options for birth control, and ultimately for abortion, adoption, all these kind of murky areas. Then we meet one of the main doctors in this collective, Evelyn. She has a past that begins with it in the book in 1960, when things are obviously very different than they are now, and even different than they were in 1980. She, like Nancy, becomes pregnant, and she is actually sent to one of these homes. Now, I've heard of them. I know they're not great, but I was floored by the research Heather Marshall did in this book. One of the things I learned that I now tell everyone, I'm awful at parties now, is that the young women who went to these homes not only had to stay there for 9 months alone, no concept of what birth would look like or feel, but when they were done, they had to return to the home and earn their board for months, helping take care of the babies, living apart from the other women they met, and just, again, being completely without support. So as uplifting as I make this book sound, what's really special is when Heather Marshall connects these three women. There is a mystery, you know, we don't quite know if, is Nancy the daughter from the letter? Is she not? What happened to the babies that these women gave up? But there's this mystery driving it, but what really drives the book is just how much grace the author gives the women. It's not a political book. It's not a book with a heavy-handed message, but it is very much about the choice to be a mother, whatever that means for you. She discusses even for women who want to be mothers, what the obstacles are, what the barriers are. And it just goes so beautifully from era to era, discussing the different rights, the different obstacles, the different perspectives. And I think every woman should read it. I think every man should read it. And a fun fact, the author was not pregnant when she wrote the book, but was when she was editing. And she actually went back and kind of rewrote things and added a little more compassion for herself. And it's an incredible book, really beautifully done. So that is Looking for Jane. My next selection is No Two Persons, which you might know the author, Erica Baumeister, who did The Scent Keeper, which is a big, I believe maybe Reese Witherspoon pick. This is a much shorter little book, but very, very special. In this book, there is a girl named Alice, and like all of us, she loves books. She finds them just utter magic, and she has kind of a neglectful home life, so she really finds an escape in these books. But when she meets an author, she decides, oh, I can be the magician instead of the magic receiver, which is my favorite line of the year. After many, many years and many, many drafts, if there are any writers in the room, you'll know what that feels like, finally writes a book called Theo. But writing this book does not come without a major transformation in her life, a big tragedy that allows her to kind of access the depth that lets her write this book. So she writes the book, she publishes it, and she does not care what happens to it. She doesn't care if it's a bestseller. She doesn't care if it wins awards. No Two Persons, I just saw in the chat. But she feels kind of cathartic release of having it out there. The book then follows the book that she writes, Theo. And we see it go through 9 readers, very different people who pick it up because, you know, a bookseller recommended it. My favorite is a man who gets dumped by his girlfriend and she leaves the book on her nightstand in his apartment. So he reads it. And they're not connected in the least. They make brief cameos in each chapter, but no connections whatsoever except this book. And I wrote down a little quote. A lot of times when we review books, you know, we say how we feel about the books, but we know it could vary to reader to reader. No two people read the same book. The author, Erica Baumeister, really takes that theme and runs with it. And the way that her book transforms people and enriches their lives, but in completely different ways, is just beautiful. I know that we're all great readers and probably therefore great recommenders of books, but I think if you have a person in your life who is just a reader and you don't really know what they like or what they would want to read, I think this is it. I can't imagine any book lover not adoring this. Okay. And I'm not saying I saved the best for last, but I did save the best for last. This is The Leftover Woman by Jean Kwok. I know Carol was like this one very much too. So this is about two mothers, Rebecca and Jasmine. Now, both women have been affected by China's very controversial one-child policy. Rebecca is an American publishing executive, very wealthy, privileged life, and she cannot conceive, so she and her husband adopt a young Chinese girl. Jasmine lives in China and was born of the one-child policy, but also horrifically affected by it. She married a very abusive man, they had a daughter, and the daughter did not survive. And given China's one-child policy, she needs to really figure this out. When we meet Jasmine, however, we learn a very dark secret. Her daughter did in fact survive, and her husband gave her up for adoption. So now she is in America to find her daughter, get her life back, and become the mother she always wanted to be. There's just one problem. Her daughter already has a mother, her adoptive mother, Rebecca. Now, already you're probably assuming that Rebecca would be the villain. She, you know, she adopted a Chinese daughter. Maybe she doesn't know the culture. Maybe she doesn't care. What Jean Kwok does that makes this book so remarkable is that both women love this daughter. Both women are perfectly suitable mothers, perfectly adoring mothers. And as they kind of both race closer to Jasmine discovering, you know, getting to reunite with her daughter, and Rebecca discovering that Jasmine, or that her daughter's real mother is here in the country, no one emerges as the villain. Both women are entirely sympathetic. And that grace and sympathy paired with the propulsive, speedy, speedy mystery plot just makes this book unputdownable. I stayed up till 3 a.m. reading it, and then I got to the book's major twist, which I won't reveal. And I was texting all my friends like, okay, can't talk tomorrow. I will be passed out, because I couldn't stop. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous book about, again, the choice to be a mother, but also about how these policies have far-reaching effects in other countries and on the course of a life. It's really incredible. Jean Kwok is a great writer, but this is the best thing she's done yet, and I know the next will be better.
Rebecca, I completely agree with you on that. And I also think the last chapter of that book is really amazing. And so don't cheat and read the end, folks, because you're going to want to, that's going to be a little kernel that's given to you at the end. And also, I interviewed about 180 authors this over the course of Book Reporter Talks To, and Jean is one that I've done recently. And we don't give anything away in the interview, but you may want to hear, you know, take a listen to that before or after you read the book. Rebecca, thanks as always. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Rebecca. All right. Our next guest is Pamela Kramer. Pam retired after a career split between practicing law and teaching dual language students and gifted students. She enjoyed combining her love of books and her love of animals with her teaching. She was the national book reviewer for Examiner.com and a contributor to HuffPost. Now she reviews on her blog and, of course, on Book Reporter. In addition to recommending adult books, she loves reviewing children's books and including teaching ideas in the reviews. She's very involved in animal rescue and will read almost any book about animals. And Pam, it's great to have you here. And I know that you have reviewed a fair share of books for us about animals. And I always love how passionate you are about the subject in your reviews. I'm a dog lover myself, so I really appreciate your passion for that. And it really comes through in your reviews.
Thank you. And I also appreciate if there's, you know, if I offer a book and just say, I got this one, it's really good. You guys almost always say, yeah, we'll run the review, because there's a lot of good books out there about dogs and rescue.
Absolutely. Some of them aren't on my radar too. So it's always great when you bring them to my attention. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate that.
And if anybody's ever interested in adopting a dog or has any questions about rescue, I'm here.
Perfect.
Okay. So has some people met? Thank you so much for doing this. I love sharing my favorite books, and it's hard to narrow it down, but I don't have a theme necessarily. Two of mine are historical fiction. And then one is just fun. So the first one is The Woman with the Cure. I read this almost a year ago. So the details are a little fuzzy, but this book reminded me a lot of a book I had read the year before, which is Lessons in Chemistry, which I hope everybody's read because it's an amazing book. And I'm kind of enjoying this the series too, although it's never quite as good as the book. But this one reminded me of that because a very strong female character. And whereas this, though, is based on a real woman, and it's based at the time of trying to find a cure for polio. And I have not known much about that. I remember as a child, you know, getting my vaccine, and but I didn't realize that they really didn't have a cure for it when I was born. I've never read about it, really. I knew that there was the Salk and the Sabin, and that Sabin had the live and Salk had the killed virus. And I always wondered why they went with the live virus instead of the killed. You'd think the killed would be safer. You find out why in this book. And we always think of the race to find the cure for polio is between these two men, Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin. And what this book shows you is that there were so many women involved in the background that this vaccine would never have been created if it hadn't been for the women. That never got any credit because women never got credit, and to some extent probably still don't. At one point in this book, when they were testing the killed virus, Salk's killed virus, a woman who worked for NIH, this is true, a woman who worked for NIH went to the factory where they were creating the virus, and she looked and she saw that they had vats of a live virus and vats of the killed virus in the same place. And she said, there could be contamination. But she was a woman and no one listened to her. And because of contamination, hundreds of people died. Thousands of people got polio. And they said they nixed the killed virus because that happened. So then they went to Sabin's. But this woman that this is about, her name is Dr. Dorothy Horstmann. And what you find out in the beginning is that she went through medical school, but nobody would, and she had a stellar academic career, and nobody would allow her to do a residency because she was a woman. So I think she applied to Vanderbilt, but she used her initials. So they accepted her based on her grades and her studies, but they didn't know she was a woman. And when they got there, when she got there, they were shocked, but they were kind of stuck. But she was always treated as second class and never as good as the men. But she was the one that really discovered 10 years before the men did and finally agreed with her that polio goes from the gut to the blood before it gets to the nervous system. And if they had just listened to her and allowed her to do her research, there would have been a polio vaccine that much sooner. It's just, I think I've already talked enough about this because I need other books to get to, but it's a very, very powerful book, and it's very engaging and very interesting as well. What's my next? I don't think I have to do them in order. Cro-Mary. I first met the author, virtually, Kathleen Grissom, when I had a book club that read her book, The Kitchen House, which was published 2010, maybe? I don't even know, but it was a while ago. And when we did our book club talk, she phoned in and we got to talk to her. And it was such a treat because she told us this kind of mystical story about how she sort of dreamt what she wrote in the story. And so she learned about this person who was she was at a place and she had a vision of this little girl who goes up a hill that was called Negro Hill. And there's a Black woman hanging there. And then later her father comes and tells her about some of his ancestors somebody was telling her about the ancestors. Two parents were killed on the ship. There were three orphans. The two boys, they were able to figure out what happened to them. But the little girl, they never knew what happened to the little girl. And she's like, that's the little girl that I saw in my vision running up the hill. So The Kitchen House is based on this little girl who becomes an indentured servant at the age of 7 because her parents died on the ship. And it takes place in the South on a plantation. And it's a very powerful book, but that's not the book I'm talking about. I'm sorry. So In 2002, she was in Saskatchewan, and she was at a Crow reservation, and she saw a woman, a 20-year-old woman, who was dressed as this woman named Crow Mary. And the woman said, "I'm Crow Mary. When I was 16, I saw a massacre, and four women were taken into this fort. They were going to be raped and killed. And I knew that, and I went in and saved them." And that was true. And she got shivers, and she said, "I have to write about this." So the whole reason that I gave the mystical background is that was in 2002. So she started researching it, but something wouldn't let her write the story back then. And then what she says, if you go to her website, is she realized that the story from the kitchen house, there was still one of the characters who said, "You have to write my story first. You haven't finished." So she wrote a sequel to the kitchen house. And then she was able to do Crow Mary. So Crow Mary is about this woman who actually existed. She did such meticulous research for this book. The Crow people and the descendants of Crow Mary helped her. One of the guys had researched this battle that happened during that time for 12 years. He had researched this battle, gave her all of his notes and said, "Use it in your story." They read the book. They made sure it was accurate in terms of the Crow culture and things that happened to Crow Mary. In fact, her great-granddaughter wrote the introduction to the book. So that's how authentic it is. It's very powerful. And it's about this woman who, in this time when women were definitely, especially Native American women, were treated as second-class citizens, she really took a lot of power into her own hands and did what she thought was right. And and again, when she talks about this book, there's that mystical part of it as well. She says that she would visualize like the teepee and what was in it and where everything was. And then she would put the character in it and just write whatever the character did. Mm-hmm. The character sort of led the story and would tell her what she was doing. And she says the same thing about the other books she reads. So it's amazing. It's based on a real woman and as factual as it could be, but there's also that kind of mystical part of it, but it's a wonderful book. My last book is just fun, Mrs. Plansky's Revenge. This is by Spencer Quinn, who writes the Chet and Bernie series, which is wonderful if you're a dog lover. These books are written from the point of view of the dog, Chet. And when I was reading Mrs. Plansky's Revenge, it doesn't sound like a dog's talking, but you can tell it's a similar narrator. Sometimes you're like, "Oh, that's something Chet would say." It's about a woman who's a little older than I am, but she's in her 70s. She just had hip replacement surgery. She's still playing tennis. She's doing great. Her husband died and she really, really misses him. He left her comfortably. She isn't super rich, but she's comfortable. And then she gets a call from her grandson and he says he's in trouble. He can't talk to his parents. He needs her to send him money. And she can't tell anyone. And she does. And somehow it's through this app. I don't even know what. But it's not her grandson. It's a hacker. They take all her money. She's got nothing left. And she's got a father who's in a nursing home. And she's like, "I don't care about the money for me, but I have to take care of my father." And she has this kind of ne'er-do-well grandson. And I think it's her son who always needs money. I mean, she's a really good woman. Well, she's pissed. She's really pissed. At herself, she feels stupid. How could she have let this happen to herself? She goes and talks to the FBI. She's like, "Well, how am I going to get my money back? You're going to get it back from me, right?" And they say, "No, you're really not going to get your money back. We're going to try to find out, but they're in Romania and really it's not going to happen." So she buys a ticket to Romania and she gets on the plane. She goes to Romania and she goes to the FBI in Romania and she sits down and the guy, like, nobody's ever done this before. Nobody's ever come to Romania to try to get their money back, especially not this 70-year-old woman. And he lets slip the name of the town where maybe the hackers live. So she goes to the town and it's about what happens. And it's delightful. It's really, really a fun read. It's got a wonderful ending. I kind of hope there's a sequel. But it's just fun. There's a couple of other books that have had powerful older women, Killers of a Certain Age, Spy Coast by Tess Gerritsen, which I just reviewed and loved. But this one is it's much lighter, but it's also really, really good. So those are my three. And if you read them, I hope you enjoy them. I really like them. Thank you guys for letting me share them and letting
me share. Thank you so much, Pam.
All right.
That was fabulous commentary. Thank you, Pam.
She has an extra book in there for folks with the Kitchen House, if you haven't read that one already too. So here we go. Our next guest is Ray Palin. Ray is an award-winning actor, drama teacher, and former executive producer director for 15 plus years of a highly successful regional theater group that's still based on Long Island. He is also a published playwright with several short plays being registered with the Writers Guild of America. And he currently works as a drama teacher in Lake County, Florida. Welcome, Ray. Our very, 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 how many books have you reviewed this year?
I'll end the year with over 200 read, and I think most of those were reviews, so a lot.
Amazing. A lot of books reviewed this year, yes, which we're grateful for. So tell us about your three.
Well, I love, you know, bringing that up. It's, and I, as I always tell Tom, it's one of the most difficult tasks of the year to come up with a top 10 or 20. When you read that many, you literally got a deep dive into even recalling the ones you read earlier in the year. So it's fun. So I went through that exercise. I did my top 20, sent them out, Tom, and these ended up being my top three for the year. And two of them are also ones that came out far earlier in the year, which is, you know, which it seems to be a pattern with everyone, because like I've heard others say, it's so easy to recall the ones you've just read recently, but those that really resonate with you, you can't forget them. So my going in reverse order, my number three book of the year was Small Mercies from Dennis Lehane. And I can't say enough about Dennis. He's, I think, one of the finest writers out there. I love everything he does. I see him as like a modern day Raymond Chandler with a social conscience. So it's, he's got that grit, he's got that noir, but he's seems to have elevated himself over the last decade to do more socially driven novels. I still put him in kind of a threesome with Michael Connelly and George Pelicanos. They're almost interchangeable for me with that style, but he's almost broken away from the pure, you know, noir and gotten a deeper. Small Mercies is kind of a mix of his crime background with social, because it's based on a true event that happened in his native town of Boston in 1974, when there was a lot of social and political unrest, specifically about a big busing vote that was coming to a head. It takes place in the southy part of Boston. A lot of tension between the whites and blacks there. And he then bases this terrific crime and family tale in the midst of that background. So it was hard to look away from this novel. And he never pulls any punches. There's a protagonist who's a woman who's not terribly likable named Mary Pat, who has a 17-year-old daughter who goes missing one night. And it turns out she may have been part of a foursome of white youths who chased a young black man down into the subway and forced him onto the tracks, where he was struck and killed. She disappeared after that event. So now you've not only got that crime happening on the eve of this big busing vote, but now her daughter's disappeared. And it's just, as it goes into Mary Pat's background, as well as the role she's playing against the busing, it really sets things at a very eerie juxtaposition. And I think it was one of the most powerful novels Lehane's ever written. He actually, if I find a really good quote in the book, I'll write it down and often include it in the review. And I took this one from the book because it really, really moved me. I think it tells the story in a snapshot. She's being questioned by a police detective, Mary Patton. She says, "My life was my daughter. They took my life when they took hers. I'm not a person anymore, Bobby. I'm a ghost. I'm a testament." That's what ghosts are. They're testaments to what never should have happened and must be fixed before their spirits leave the world. So to have that placed in what could simply be called a crime novel just feels wrong. I mean, I could have read that in a Faulkner or a Hemingway book. And that's what just puts Lehane on another plane. So I can't say enough about Small Mercies. I hope like some of his similar work, like on Bird, where Bird Box that he gets to get this one in either a series or a streaming film, because it's really powerful. My second one, which was kind of a playful one, because with the amount of books I read, it's rare that something surprises me or even comes across as new. And this writer, Luc Dumas, his second novel was called The Paleontologist. And I love this first novel, History of Fear. It was really good. But this one blew me away because he literally wrote something I've never seen before. I refer to it as a mashup of Michael Crichton and Stephen King. And I don't think I've ever read anything that had that duality in it. Mm-hmm. He's set the story during the pandemic. He's got a paleontologist from Pennsylvania who's at basically an abandoned museum because they're shut down right in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. But he's picking up from the previous paleontologist who is no longer there under mysterious circumstances. It's just him and a security guard in this building. And as he, you know, finds himself there and trying to follow up on the work of his predecessor, he's learning that the place may be haunted. Now, it's not just haunted by possible ghosts, but where Dumas really takes a leap, and this is something I never considered before. Often you'll talk about, you know, haunted graveyards and the bones and the remains that are there. He actually surmises that possibly the skeletons of the dinosaurs that are there could very well be possessed and have their ghosts themselves. One of those ghosts that it may have opened up is his sister, who disappeared decades earlier when she was 6 years old. And now he's caught up in that. So not only is he working on these bones, which may be producing all of the supernatural happenings in this museum, but now his predecessor and some other characters from the town who worked with him may have been behind his sister's abduction. So it just blew me away. It was great on every level. Suspense, it had enough scares without ever being gory, and just, you know, just was a lot of fun. I even Facebook messaged him. He wasn't accepting friends. I said, I have to tell you how unique it was. And I was surprised he got back to me and then read the review and was grateful. So that was nice. I just enjoy anything that's different. And I don't know if I read another novel like that ever again. My number one of the year, and I'm actually happy that I've seen in just last week, a couple of different sites have already had this selected as their top mystery thriller book, was S.A. Cosby's All the Sinners Bleed, which just was released very early in the year. I will never forget this novel. I talked about racial tensions in the Lehane novel. This one now is set in the South, in the modern day South, where if you're familiar with some parts there, they're still living the Civil War. So it's there's a lot going on here, and it's a very unique county in Virginia that has just elected the very first Black sheriff ever. And the county is called Chiron, which I thought was already chilling there that they would use the name of the ferryman from hell as the name of the county, if that was as a precursor for whatever was going to happen. So this gentleman, Titus, is not only dealing with backlash, racial tension, massive divide that goes back almost centuries in this small county in Virginia, but he's caught up now in a very real serial killer event, which has its roots inside some of the top most supposedly decent residents of the town. And as he gets deeper, he's not only battling the racial divide, but also opening up some really, really old wounds and some families that go back historically to a time where, you know, some of the evil things that this new killer has done decades ago, centuries ago, would have been unfortunately acceptable in that town. So he's really facing that. He uses a quote to open up the novel from Joseph Conrad that says, "The belief in a supernatural source of evil is not necessary. Men alone are quite capable of every wickedness." So mm-hmm. He, right from the top, says, we're going to talk about evil, but we're going to place it in an area that he lives and is familiar with that is still battling this tension and divide between races every single day. And it's not for the faint of heart. Cosby's, you know, in his previous books, doesn't pull punches, does let the blood spill freely. And it is a tough book to look away from, but just had some scenes and moments that are unforgettable.
Mm. Thank you so much, because, you know, that is one of the books I'm really looking forward to reading, was All the Sinners Bleed. And he is actually going to be one of the guests. He's one of the guests of honor at the Hamptons Whodunit back in East Hampton next April. And I can't wait to meet him, and I can't wait to hear more about his writing, because I've been hearing about him for a while, but I haven't read him. So thanks for concluding him and all those really good. Dennis Lehane is amazing. And you really captured what he's doing with Small Mercies.
Sure.
So thank you. Really appreciate you as always. Review on.
Cheers. Cheers, guys. Love seeing you.
I'll see you too.
All right. And joining us now is Eileen Nickel. Eileen had a long career writing code for computers in the tech industry. She is now retired and still enjoys writing, although for human audiences, book reviews, magazine articles, poetry, and long fiction. When she's not babysitting or her grandson or reading, she sails in Alaska, does yoga, plays tennis, volunteers in the community, and studies Buddhism. And Eileen is joining us right now. It's great to see you, Eileen.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
So now talk about your three picks, which are three really good ones.
Yes. And these aren't in any particular order of how much I liked them. But they did all come out this year. I did review all of them. First one I want to talk about is Victory City by Salman Rushdie. Most of us probably know that he's been subject to vast persecution his whole life for his writing. This book came out 6 months after he was attacked and wounded by a knife-wielding fanatic at a lecture. So I think he's just proving what he said. This starts out saying words are the only victors. And I think he's proving it with this. Like many of his other books, this is a rollicking novel. It's really entertaining. It's set in India, like 15th century, but it's, you know, it's fictional. There's some magical realism element to it, I would say. And it begins with this 9-year-old girl named Pampa Campana. And she's standing at a funeral pyre that her mother jumps on. So she's left orphaned and she's horrified, but she's visited by a goddess who grants her extraordinary powers. And she vows to use them to ensure that no woman ever does that again, jumps on a funeral pyre. So she ends up growing up in a cave with an ascetic monk. And she grows in, of course, up to be a beautiful girl, of course. And her reputation then draws two itinerant goat herds and former soldiers who are named Huka and Buka. And they come with some seeds, and she tells them to plant the seeds, which they do. And they're skeptical. But the next day, this glorious city just blooms out of the desert, complete with people. And it's an egalitarian city. She's true to her word. To create a better society. She knows she's going to live 247 years. It's a long time. And over the centuries, she sees her creation thrive and then wither and bloom and fade. She first marries Huka, the older brother, although she reserves the right to keep her lover, who's a red-haired Portuguese horse trader named Domingo Nunes. So the first three children she has with Huka are red-haired daughters. And then when he dies, she marries Buka, the other brother, and she marries him for love. But the sons that she bears him are kind of impetuous and spoiled. So this has all the elements of just palace intrigue and just a really great story. She says, it's hard for me to love anyone with my whole heart because I know they are going to die. So as the story progresses, it focuses more on the end of her life and how she ends up humbled, but she's writing the story, this epic story. I really like this. It sounds like a lot, and it is a lot, but he's just very entertaining, and he's funny too. So there's a lot of humor in there. One of the quotes I loved was, there are sad sacks and lonely hearts made sad sackier and lonely heartier by all the portraits of other people's joy. And he just plays with language like that, which is one reason why I love him. The next book I'm talking about is called Monsters by Claire Dederer. I am fortunate enough to live in the same area that Claire lives in. And so I've met her, and I actually got to take a class from her about memoir. And I admire her honesty first and foremost. And she does not write quickly. I believe she probably worked on this book for, 6 to 10 years. But she is she's just a very rigorous thinker. And this collection of essays called Monsters is about how we should respond to great art made by not so great humans. And so she goes through that. She asks a lot of tough questions, and she does not give definitive answers. She helps us think about all these questions. Her skill as a memoirist contributes to the power of the essays, because she's sharing the political and social context of the times when she was considering each aspect of the problem. From the election of Donald Trump to the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, we remember as we read along how, quote unquote, monstrous questions and behaviors resonated and still resonate in our culture and politics. She talks about predictable subjects like Woody Allen, Roman Polanski, and Picasso, but she also tackles the way we as consumers feed off the bad behavior of our genius artists. And here's a quote: "The sometimes truth is that we are interested in, and yes, even attracted to bad people. To pretend that there's no allure to bad men is to sidestep reality." I think she's just a really worthy companion along thinking about these lines. And I really appreciated her, like I said, her honesty and her rigorous writing. She doesn't let us or herself off easily. And in a chapter titled, "Am I a Monster?" she wonders whether her ambition as a writer has stolen valuable energy from her children. So like I said, there's no easy answers, but this is like exploring them with a very wise and funny friend. And the third book that I wanted to talk about is called King of the Armadillos. I had never heard of Wendy Chin Tanner, who's the author of this novel. She's a poet. And I found out about the book through a newsletter from Cheryl Strayed. And I thought that this sounds really interesting. So I requested to review it. And I really like bringing those books to the attention of a wider audience. Anyway, this story is about, it's kind of loosely based on her father, who is a Chinese immigrant. And it starts in 1954. He's living in Brooklyn with his father, who is running a laundry. They don't have much money, and he is diagnosed with Hansen's disease. And when I say he, I don't mean her father, because this is a novel, but I think it's based on his experiences. And the guy is named Victor Chin. And so when he's diagnosed with Hansen's disease, they do not have money for treatment, but they find out about the Carville National Leprosarium, because Hansen's disease is also leprosy, and it's a federal institution in Louisiana, and they will treat him for free. So a nurse takes him down there on the train, and he's totally a fish out of water, because he's a Brooklyn boy. He's never even had his own bedroom, and now he goes to this big, southern sort of plantation type place with dorms and trees and wide open lawns. The novel just follows his whole progression through, it's very linear. And you could tell that a poet wrote it, because it's just very visceral. But it covers the treatment that he receives. He gets an operation. And you learn a lot about Hansen's disease and how he suffers from that, and how it does help. But he finds out that you have to have like 12 tests in a row monthly that are negative before they will consider letting you go. And that's a tough thing to meet. It's a pretty tough disease. And so he ends up going to high school. They have a high school at the institution, and he has to admit as he settles in that there are some advantages to being there because he's able to, for one thing, he has his own room. And for another thing, they prescribe piano lessons to strengthen his hands. And he discovers that he has a really profound musical gift and that he loves it. And it just sort of takes him away. He has some tough choices to make at that towards the end of the novel, partly based on his musical gift. And you also learn about his family back in Brooklyn. She really does a good job of pulling you into the story. I really enjoyed it. It has a nuanced plot with relatable characters at about a place and situation that I had never heard of before. So I would recommend it.
Yeah, it's always great when you have a debut novel like that, that maybe you didn't know, like, oh, this is going to be one of my favorite books of the year. And then it turns out to be. So it's always great when you have that discovery.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for sharing those selections.
You're welcome.
Great to see you.
Good to see you.
Now it's time to hear from Kate Ayers. Kate retired from a career as a court reporter in the Pacific Northwest, and she now enjoys the bulk of her time traveling and writing. She's completed novels in her Mysteries with a Wine List series, three in her Eyes and Ears series, and is currently working on another. And so now we have Kate joining us. Thanks, Kate. So nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
So, on with your selections.
Okay. Well, first off, I have the Kala. I have Kala, which is, I'm not on video.
Yeah, you are. We see you. We saw you.
Am I? Okay.
Yes. Now, yes, stay there.
We see you.
Stay there.
The three books I chose tend to be because of the quirky characters. Kala herself is obviously the major one in this. I normally choose fun books, and I would generally have gone for my favorite guy, Nelson DeMille, and his really interesting characters. But I met Kala this year and a couple other new characters, and I just had to talk about them. Kala is a debut novel by Colin Walsh, an Irish writer. And it starts and takes place in the coastal town, little small coastal town of Kenlough. And there it's the summer of 2003. These are 15-year-old kids, six of them that kind of grouped together. There were five originally, and then Helen came along and she's kind of an outsider. And Kala was the one who pretty much took her under her wing. Kala is a motherless kind of outcast who doesn't care what other people think. And so she, for some reason, becomes the ringleader of this group. The kids get up to what 15-year-olds get up to all summer. They have a ball. They really enjoy themselves, get into trouble. And at the end of the summer, you know, it was great. It ended. And Kala disappeared. Mm-hmm. The story takes up 15 years later when Ellen comes back because her father's getting married. And at that point, one of the boys has died. And two of the other boys are back. And some bones turn up, human remains turn up, and they turn out to be Kala's. That's what happened to Kala. Somehow she died. Helen, having, you know, really been saved by Kala, would like very much to find out what happened. She's one of those, she's kind of a journalist type and a very curious person. So they start to, she kind of tries to take a couple of the others that are back for that 15-year reunion sort of thing and sees if they will all try to help her. Uncovering the past, though, in this small Irish town is a dangerous enterprise. There was a lot going on back then, and it hasn't changed. the danger that they uncovered or that Kala got into is still there. So it's a really interesting mystery, and it's a really grisly mystery. But what's even more fun is the interaction between these kids. They're very different. Each one of them is different. They have their own very, very unique personalities, and their interactions are you know, argumentative, like kids are, and they argue, they fall in love, they have just, you know, grumpiness. And then they, you know, work on trying to find out what happened. It's a real moody Irish psychological thriller with all sorts of just murder mystery thrown in. It's a little bit of everything. It's a really spectacular review. I mean, debut. That's what I meant. Next, I chose Richard Osman's The Last Devil to Die, the Thursday Mystery Club. The four pensioners who are the main characters in this, Elizabeth, Joyce, Ron, and Ibrahim, they're just characters. They're just characters that you can't not love. I've only seen them in one other of the Richard Osmonds, but Elizabeth is kind of the leader. I think they're all probably in their 70s. Joyce is kind of a busybody, but she's also, she tries to find her love by giving people food. She's a cook, and they, rather than just retiring, I think they all live in a retirement community, and rather than just, you know, playing pickleball or whatever it is, they have decided to form a mystery club, murder club. So they get together every Thursday night and pick a murder and try to solve it. They're usually already solved murders, so, you know, they take the circumstances and put them together and try to work on them. But this time they have one that's actually a real murder. It's one of their friends, actually, that got murdered. It was a local antique dealer. And they don't want to leave it up to the police. You know, they're pretty sure they're better at things than the police anyway. So they get started on that. And, of course, we get the detective that comes in. And she's, of course, never happy to have help from a bunch of pensioners. It's not fun. But in the meantime, I think the background story is part of what really got me in this book, because Elizabeth has some problems at home that are very touching, emotional, and she kind of needs to step back in this one and let Joyce take over. Joyce is happy to do it, but not so much. It's hard for her to do. But Elizabeth's problem is just too much for her to handle. The Thursday Murder Club too. That made it a real poignant story. And that's part of what made it even more important that it be one of my favorites this year, because it really was a big deal. I think that in addition to the murder club four, who are the ones that actually, you know, drive the book, there are also the cops. There's a couple of cops that they really are kind of kicked off the case by somebody else. And so they start hanging around the murder club and starting to really kind of get involved with them and join them, and their personalities become part of it too. And then I think one of the police people gets involved with one of the guys, and it's a whole lot of fun. And, you know, they solve the mystery. Mm-hmm. So it's even more fun. It's really kind of about characters, but it's also solving mystery. So it's a good deal. And then, of course, the much anticipated book of the year, The Mystery Guest. Yeah. I didn't read The Maid. I'm going to have to now, of course. But this one was so hyped, I had to read it, and I love mysteries. Molly Gray is, again, just such a character. She's not just quirky. She's just really awkward. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she, as a we learn about her in this book, her childhood background a lot, because she was kind of held back in school when she was around 11 years old because she was not fitting in. It wasn't that she wasn't getting through the classes. She was doing fine in the classes, but they called Gran in, who she lives with, her Gran. They called Gran in to tell her she wasn't going to be advanced to the next level because she just didn't fit in. And of course, Gran was definitely a strong woman, and she said, you know, kind of BS, and took her with her and took her to her job for, you know, as long as she's not advancing, why let her go through the rest of the school year? Took her to her job when, as a maid. Well, I guess Molly just always wanted to be a maid. So then we go forward to where Molly is a maid. She's head maid at the Regency, Grand Regency Hotel. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is her dream job, head maid. Well, at this point, we come into the story where she's gathering her crew and staff, and they're getting the tea room ready for a big event that night. Seems that J.D. Grimthorpe, the famous author, is going to be making a special presentation. So they get it all ready. Everybody's excited. The staff, the presenters, the people coming, and a funky group called the Lambs, which they're the Ladies Auxiliary Mystery Book Club. And they all gather, seat themselves, they're all ready. And Grimthorpe comes out, he gets himself at the dais, gets himself a cup of tea, and he drops dead. Well, you know, of course, then they have to find out who done it, and they decide it wasn't natural causes. So they go with Detective Stark, who comes in, and she was there 3 years before, I guess, in The Maid, which I will be reading, where a guest named Black, Mr. Black of some sort, he died. And the detective apparently zeroed in on Molly. Well, the fun part is that the detective zeroes in on Molly again, but she learns a lot more about Molly in this one, as do we, because Molly is honest, straightforward, and you'd think that sometimes with a detective that doesn't seem like the best. I mean, it is the best, but if you have anything at all that's a little bit off, it can be revealing. Well, Molly doesn't hold back on anything. And Stark starts understanding that Molly really has some insights that are pretty interesting. So you learn a lot about Molly in this, and you learn how quirky she is and how fun she is. It really is a kick. The things that she learns about other people and people learn about her, and the mystery of who done it. And there are some real surprising interactions between some of them and surprising relationships between them. Anyway, everybody should read it because it's just too much fun. And Nita Prose is a very good writer.
I totally agree, Kate. I'm going to be interviewing her on Monday. I can't look, oh, cool. I'm really looking forward to it. I had lunch with her last week. And also, if in that same vein of the books that you've just been talking about, if anybody hasn't read The Spy Coast by Tess Gerritsen, highly, highly recommend that as well.
I want to.
Yeah, really, really good. Tom, you're up with our last guest. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Yes, and last but certainly not least is Stuart Schiffman. Stuart is a lifelong avid reader. After serving 22 years as a state court judge in Illinois, he began his second career teaching and writing. He has written hundreds of reviews for Book Reporter, Illinois Times, a central Illinois newspaper, and several legal publications. His subjects include sports, history, biography, and legal novels. Stuart, great to see you.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be show. Here. It's great to be the cleanup man because this book I'm going to be talking about tonight is a baseball book.
Yay.
Why We Love Baseball, A History in 50 Moments by Joe Posnanski. Now, let me start off by recognizing that there are probably a lot of you who are not baseball fans. This is, even if you're not a baseball fan, you're only 1 or 2 degrees separated from someone who is a baseball fan. So if you're not going to get this book for yourself, it's the time of the year when you should be buying books. And this is one that you should buy for your baseball fan friend. I bought a copy for my grandson, my 13-year-old grandson, and got it autographed. And he was very excited when he received it as a gift. The title is a little misleading. It's not 50 great moments in baseball. When you start adding them up, he's got well over 100. And the book is written just basically by Posnanski talking about the events. He goes from 50 down to 1. Many of them, even if you know a little bit about baseball, you'll recognize the events themselves. But the wonderful thing about this book is that he adds something to each and every event. And when I read this book this summer, I was just enthralled, and it led me to so many remembrances and things that I had forgotten over my baseball life that I can't say enough about it. And so anybody out there who has a baseball fan on their list, this is the book you need to get. Posnanski is a very good writer. He's written books about Buck O'Neill. He wrote another great baseball book, The 100 Greatest Baseball Players. So if you're a true baseball fan, pick up all of his books. And if you're not a true baseball fan, but just a kind of a fan, get one for a friend of yours, and I think you'll be very happy. My next book is called The Upstairs Delicatessen by Dwight Garner. Some of you may recognize that name because Dwight Garner is a book reviewer for the New York Times. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to confess that I started reading this book under very false pretenses because I actually thought it was a book about delicatessens. And delicatessens are kind of a dying thing across America. And I wanted to read a little bit about them and learn a little bit about them. And it only took me a few pages in the introduction to discover that it wasn't a book about delicatessens, but it was even better. It's a book about Garner is a foodie, a reader, and his wife is a chef. So he's written a book about all of those things. The chapter titles for the books in the book are breakfast, lunch, dinner, shopping, alcohol, and naps. He covers a wide range of subjects, and in each subject, basically what he does is he starts out by talking about books that might cover various food subjects and authors who might cover various food subjects and just eating. And he goes through it. This is a book that I couldn't quite come up with a way to describe it. And the best way I can describe it is it's a biography and a bibliography at the same time. Because as you read this book, he will tell you about authors that you might think are very interesting based upon his description. He might tell you about books that you might think are very interesting based upon his description. And you're going to end up, I think, which just as I did, going out and looking up those books and finding those books. So this is going to open up a wide range of books. And his writing is just very engaging. I think that's one of the best things about this book. It sucks you in is the best way for me to describe it. my third and final book. And the copy I'm going to hold up is different than the copy you might see in your stores. It's Larry McMurtry Alive. Now, I've been a reader of Larry McMurtry just kind of off and on for many years. And in fact, Tom gave me the assignment a few years ago when unfortunately McMurtry passed away. I remember he contacted me and asked me if I would write his obituary for Book Reporter, which I was happy to do after some research and on a deadline. You know, usually you get a few more weeks, you get a few weeks to write your articles. This was a very quick one, but I learned a lot about McMurtry at that time, and I became more a reader of his books. I'm sure some of you have heard about his, have read or have been exposed to his works along the way. When McMurtry was a very young writer in his early 20s, he sold his first novel, a novel called, which became the movie HUD. I think Horsemen Pass By was the title of the novel. It became the movie HUD, and it was actually filmed in McMurtry's hometown of Archer, Texas. He continued to write. He was a very prolific writer. He was a very disciplined writer. He used to write 10 pages a day. That was the first thing he would do every morning. He would get to write his 10 pages a day on an old-fashioned typewriter and then go about his other works. One of his next books was a book called The Last Picture Show, which became an Academy Award-winning, Oscar-winning movie, again filmed in Texas. Later on, he wrote Terms of Endearment, which was a very, very big, successful movie and book. And he, as I say, he wrote many books, but then his third, his final great book was the 900-page epic Lonesome Dove, mm-hmm. which became the iconic television show and a series that I think probably everybody has seen. It's probably still on your television someplace. So McMurtry wrote about the modern West and the old West. And one of the things he tried to do was kind of tell the truth about the old West. You know, the old West there's a line in a movie, this is the West, sir, when the lie doesn't support the facts, print the lie. When the legend doesn't support the facts, print the legend. McMurtry tried to write about the real West. And I think he did that. And he was, I forgot his last and final achievement was, of course, he wrote the screenplay for the Academy Award winning film Brokeback Mountain. Mm-hmm. And he received an Oscar for that accomplishment and was very happy to come to the Academy Awards and accept the Oscar in a tuxedo jacket, blue jeans, cowboy boots, and a Western hat. Mm-hmm. So he was a Westerner from till the very end. He also was a very avid book dealer and book collector. And he had a bookstore in Washington, D.C. He had a very large bookstore in Archer City, Texas. And I'm sad to say that one of the items on my bucket list was to get to his bookstore in Archer City, Texas, but I never got there. He passed away, and the bookstore has been sold to Skip Gaines, who I am told is a fellow who appears on some type of one of these shows where they reality shows where they rebuild houses. And he has he lives in Texas though. And whether the bookstore is going to be reopened or not is still not known. But this is another wonderful book. Doherty is a very good writer, a very good biographer. I will say though, in all honesty, he used a lot of material from McMurtry's life, McMurtry's own writings and novels, and a lot of notes that he got from the family. So I'm not sure that this is the most critical of biographies, but I think it's a wonderful place to start with a great writer's life. Wow. Those are my three.
Wow, that's terrific. And you know, we had a big piece about McMurtry when about the library, Tom, the whole town. Remember the reader who reached out to us and gave us about that piece? Shared us that piece?
That's right. Yeah. And we featured the ceremony in the newsletter and wrote about the bookstore. So yeah, I was familiar with what was going on there. Yeah. So. It's too bad that you didn't get to, you know, keep that on your bucket list.
The bucket list just has to add something else instead.
Yeah.
Well, everyone, that was just terrific. We want to thank all of our reviewer guests tonight. You all did such a fabulous job. I'm proposing a toast to these reviewers. I don't have a drink handy right now, but we are lucky to have them. And we consider ourselves very, very lucky that we get to share their work with you each week. The fact that we can get out and get not only the books that we're finding, but they're finding books for us as well. And we consider ourselves very, very lucky about that, as well as being lucky enough to have all of you as readers, because let's put it this way, we could be writing all the things that we did, but you know what? If you guys aren't reading what we're working on, then we're just not, you know, doing anything special. We're going to follow up an email with a link to this presentation as both a video and a podcast in case you want to review it again, share it with friends. And yes, we will once again include the book list, which will have pictures of the book covers. We really thought we had that covered this year. I sent it out, I guess, about 5 o'clock this afternoon to everybody. Reminder that we'll be doing our next Bookuccino Live book preview event on Wednesday, January 10th at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We'll cover books releasing in January through February 6th and look ahead at some March titles. And sign up for that is available on Book Reporter. Please keep in mind that we have done more than 180, this really scares me, Book Reporter Talks to Author interviews that are available on our YouTube channel or on the podcast, Book Reporter Talks to wherever you can find it. I'll be doing three in the next couple of days, which is kind of crazy because I swore I was not going to go into the end of the year doing this much, but guess what? It's going to happen.
We're ending the year with a big bang. For sure.
Yeah. And they need a big nap. So okay. We're going to be doing that. Also, we'll be announcing my Book Reporter Bets on Selections this Friday as well. Stay on top of everything that we're doing at the Book Report Network, like our Bookuccino Live, Lively Talk About Books monthly events, our book club events, just everything that we've got going on. Please sign up for the Book Reporter newsletter, and then you'll never miss an event. That's our tagline. Sign up, you'll never miss an event. Wishing you all a very, very, very happy holidays and an absolutely brilliant 2024. And once again, thanks to our reviewers for making this such a very, very, very special evening for all of us.
Thank you so much, everyone. All of our attendees and all of our reviewers. So much fun. Thank you all.
And Tom, thanks for being such a great co-pilot. We always have a good time, don't we, Tom?
Absolutely, we do. Seeing all these reviewers reminds me of the holidays. So, we've been doing this the last few years in December. So, seeing all of you makes it now feel like the holidays. You've become part of the holiday season for us. So,
Flip on the Christmas.
It was a lot of fun.
And here it comes. Ho, ho, ho. Here we go. It's still early December, and we still have like two more weeks of work to do. Our last update is what, the 15th?
Next 17th? Friday, yes.
Not that we're that excited. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate you all.
Thank you so much, everybody.
Okay. Thanks so much. Bye-bye now.
Happy holidays.
Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To.